Now, a national organization argues that these guidelines are outdated and that they underrepresent the number of people struggling financially in the United States, and that this could lead to problems, especially during the COVID-related economic downturn. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how poverty is measured? What would you like to see change? Has COVID-19 made your financial situation more precarious? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Shelley Gupta-Barnes is the policy director for the Kairos Center and the Poor People's Campaign. Shelley, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, can you tell us the current federal guidelines for what constitutes poverty? What do they measure? How are they set?
Well, the official poverty line is set by a household food budget that was established in the 1950s. So it's more than 50 years ago. It's almost closer to 65 years ago. And that was based on, you know, a calculation of how much a typical household or a poor household would spend on food. And the economy has changed since then. Household budgets have changed since then. How much things cost have changed. And yet the poverty line is still based on that data and that calculation from decades ago. And there are, you know, the federal government has recognized this limitation in this measurement, and a few years ago started putting out what's called the supplemental poverty measure, which looks at a broader range of both household income and expenses. So it does look at, you know, what your geographic, it has different calculations for your geography, you know, some different cost of living, and takes into account certain credits that households also receive. But even that doesn't take into account the expenses for healthcare or even the debt burdens that many households face today. And so, you know, by underrepresenting, by having a threshold on the one hand that's so low that it's not really counting the broader economic precarity that millions of people are facing, we risk our federal programs not having enough resources, not being allocated enough resources to be able to meet the needs at hand. And so this is something that the Poor People's Campaign has been paying attention to and really pushing to change along with other organizations in the country, especially as the current administration is trying to lower the definition and poverty measure even below what it currently is.
You mentioned healthcare. What are some of the expenses that loom larger in a family budget in 2020 than they did 60, 65 years ago?
So the cost of education, the cost of transportation, the cost, you know, rent actually accounting for more, a higher percentage of household income than it did 60 years ago, and maybe household, you know, food and other expenses going down as a percentage of household expenses. The cost of different utilities. We know that whether it's water or broadband or communications, these are costs that have gone up over the past decades as a percentage of household, you know, as a percentage of the household budget. All of these things have changed. The cost of childcare, health care, as I already mentioned, and then the debt burdens that households are carrying as well. All of these things are you know, profoundly different than they were 50, 60 years ago and need to be reflected in how we understand what, you know, how we're living today and therefore what the responsibility of the government is towards households that are struggling to make ends meet.
If we are, in fact, undercounting poverty in effect, what does that mean on a policy level? What changes because we don't have that more accurate grasp on how many people are struggling financially?
Well, it really limits the poverty line ends up being the baseline against which many federal programs are given appropriations. And so that it determines how much money goes into food stamps, you know, into the budget for food stamps and SNAP or for WIC, the food assistance program for women, infants, and children, or for housing allocations, and so many other programs that millions and millions of people have rely on to meet all kinds of needs. And so when we don't have an accurate measure of poverty, then those allocations are, you know, those programs are not funded or organized to the extent that they need to be to meet our needs. And you can imagine, you know, by the calculation of the Poor People's Campaign is done. So according to the federal poverty line, the official poverty measure, there are about 40 million people who live below the poverty line. We look at everyone who's looking below the poverty line, but also people who are living just above it. So that would mean, you know, for a family of four living on an income of less than $50,000 a year, or right around that. And if you look at that, then we're talking about 140 million people in this country who are poor or low income, and really no federal programs are designed to meet that kind of need. And therefore, millions, tens of millions of families are struggling, unnecessarily so, because there is an abundance in this country that could be moved to secure housing, secure water and utilities and food and health care and all the things we need if we were willing to face this pandemic of poverty.
Shali Gupta Barnes is with us from the Poor People's Campaign and the Cairo Center, looking at poverty, how we measure it in the United States. Her organization says we need a broader definition of poverty to understand the real problems in the country, and that could lead to different policy plans. Shali, what kind of policies do you see, not just when it comes to measuring poverty and maybe that shorter term relief, but policies that could help people out of poverty in the first place?
I think it's a great question. I think when we think about poverty, we have to think about it really in terms of not just an income threshold, like whether or not you earn above or below this amount of income, but whether or not our needs are met. And that in and of itself is a profound shift in our orientation in this country. And so we have to make sure that our housing is secure. And we know that because of the economic fallout from this, from the coronavirus pandemic, tens of millions of people are at risk of losing their housing in just a matter of weeks. And so this is something that is critical. We have to have our health care needs met. We have to be able to have clean water running through our faucets and be able to put healthy, nutritious food on our table and make sure our children have the kind of education that they need, that we all need to thrive in this economy, and many other things. You know, we need to be able to provide for childcare and ensure that parents can work knowing that our children are taken care of, and for elder care and for retirement and pensions. And so really taking up the question of poverty from what it takes to live, as opposed to and meeting all of our human, you know, our basic human needs, is the orientation we push for in the Poor People's Campaign.
A reaction to suggestions like these sometimes is, okay, maybe some safety nets are okay for people in the most dire need, in the most difficult situations. If we start building up safety net programs, they start to be an alternative to what people say is the more valuable path, work, finding jobs, finding better jobs for people. Do you see the one interfering with the other?
We don't, really, not at all. There has been, you know, multiple research that has, you know, from the National Employment Law Project and other institutes that have shown that, you know, this is an argument that is commonly made also against this unemployment assistance that people have been receiving for the past weeks. And there are arguments being made right now that extending unemployment is going to keep people away from work. Well, if work is paid well, and we can manage our health care and not put our health at risk and our family's health at risk, and people, the research shows that people want to work. This is a core foundation of this society and all human society. And so we don't see them as inconsistent. The platform that we've put out recently, the Jubilee platform, looks at securing work for everybody and securing the kind of safety net that can provide for those of us who can't, or who can't work, and you know, and to make sure that everybody is taken care of, regardless of whether or not we have the income to be able to afford, you know, these basic needs.
Shali, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Shali Gupta Barnes is policy director for the Kairos Center and the Poor People's Campaign. She joined us to talk about how the federal poverty line is calculated and why her organization is calling on the criteria to be changed. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin-based poverty expert to find out what's going on here in the state And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about poverty in Wisconsin? Are there things you'd like to see state, local, or federal officials do to address poverty? What do you think is the best solution to poverty? Are you one of the people maybe living under the poverty line or maybe just above it, but you feel that sense of a precarious existence? One big, say, health expense or car repair or something like that could throw the balance out of whack for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about poverty and calls to change the criteria that the federal government uses to determine the poverty level. Our last guest recently wrote an opinion piece about the issue. You can read that. We've got a link at WPR.org. Now we want to look at poverty closer to home. In Wisconsin, the poverty level seems to hover just above 10%, with a peak following the Great Recession and a more recent spike during the COVID-19 pandemic. A majority of those living in poverty are children, and while poverty remains especially high in some counties, like Milwaukee County, it is a statewide problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a lot of poverty, however you define it, in your own community, your part of the state? Do you have questions about poverty in Wisconsin and efforts to relieve it and turn it around? How does it affect you and your family now or in the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin joins us now, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard Shelley Gupta-Barnes from the Poor People's Campaign. They say, in effect, the federal measure of poverty, this long-running measure of poverty, underrepresents poverty levels in the United States. What do you think about that?
So as Shelley described, the supplemental poverty measure takes a much more comprehensive look at the set of costs and benefits that families and households face. And so it provides us with a more comprehensive, more accurate picture of who is actually experiencing poverty. That means that for some groups, we're undercounting poverty. For other groups who might benefit more from available government support, we might be overcounting poverty. Similarly, in some areas with low costs of living, we might be overcounting poverty. And in other areas with high costs of living, we might be drastically undercounting poverty. So basically, it gives us an inaccurate picture of who and where poverty is highest.
Does that drive problems with policies and policy outcomes?
Well, what it means is that most essentially, we don't get to see, when we use the official poverty measure, the effects of our policies in combating poverty. And I think this is, for me, the biggest problem with it, because we can look at our poverty measures, which don't take into account the effect of any benefit programs, like through taxes, like the earned income tax credit. And so then we look and we say, we're spending all this money on policies and our poverty rates aren't budging. But that's because of how we calculate our poverty rates, not because those programs have no effect on poverty. So we know, for example, that the earned income tax credit lifts millions of kids out of poverty, but our official poverty measure is designed in such a way that we can never capture that in our statistics.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Vernon County. Lori, hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, thank you. Yes, I called about a solution to poverty. Long ago, conservatives and honest liberals used to agree that cash assistance was the most effective way to alleviate poverty because, after all, people know best how to spend money. That's what the market tells us, so conservatives like it. So, and, you know, so anyway, so that was, so, and when we eliminated that AFDC, as we know it, and the way it was done, we lost track, it seems, of a whole lot of people who kind of fell off the rolls at that point, right? And that's what we're seeing in Milwaukee, because Milwaukee's where it started first with the voucher systems and the experiment welfare, or the work fair and the bride fair and all the rest of it. So we lost all these people where they fell away from, you know, they made it harder to get assistance in so many ways. So those are two things I'd like the guest to speak on. And then also in this time, we're seeing that we're not, that we're doing, there's a whole lot of work that goes on out here that people, that women basically don't get paid for. So maybe a universal basic income, you know, back to the cash assistance, for, would be a way to acknowledge that we can care for each other.
Lori, thanks a lot for calling, and you gave us a lot to work with there. So Lori's saying, hey, how about more straightforward cash assistance programs as opposed to, say, a housing program for this and a child care program for that and so on?
So we certainly did see in 1996 welfare reform that was modeled substantially based on what had happened in Wisconsin. And so we saw the end of Aid to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC, which was replaced by Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANFs. And what that meant, you know, it had already started happening here in Wisconsin, but what it meant across the country is that many people came off the welfare rolls, in part buoyed by a really strong national economy by that time. So there were a lot of jobs available for people to move into. We have not seen TANF be able to respond when we've had drastic increases in need, such as we did during the Great Recession and such as we're having right now. So it means that TANF is actually received by a very small minority of poor families across the United States. So it really no longer serves as a safety net for most people. There have been, as the caller discussed, recent growing calls to look at things like a universal basic income. That is a really different sort of approach to supporting families, first because it's universal. So while TANF was targeted at lower income people, a universal basic income seeks to give money to all people regardless of their income. There are also ways that there have been discussions around targeting cash assistance, for example, giving child allowances and making those child allowances larger for lower income families and for families with really young children, where those early investments can pay off in the biggest dividends and development and growth later on.
Lori, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison about poverty in Wisconsin and programs meant to tackle it. Back to your calls now. Catherine is with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience. I've lived around the poverty line for a couple of years in Michigan and in Wisconsin, and I don't think people realize really the toll that it takes when you essentially are at the poverty line, when you're, you know, maybe $1,000 annually above the cutoff, and how little of a difference that actually makes in your day-to-day life. And how, when I was in that situation, just like it almost felt like my breath is being taken away from me when I'm counting every penny. And or when I was denied Badger Care because I made about $80 a month too much and was then expected to pay a $200 premium a month for health insurance. I just wanted to share that experience with people because I think there's a lot of like moralizing and patronizing that goes into this, and people don't know what it's really like.
Catherine, thanks for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Sarah, your thoughts.
What Catherine was saying was so important. So first, there is so much judgment that goes on connecting people's moral worth to their income, and that really neglects understanding the context that leads people to have the incomes that they do. And as the first caller said, it often neglects to value the unpaid work that so many people do in their households and in their communities. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on what Catherine was talking about, was the importance to some administrative details of how programs are set up. So when programs are set up to have what we call a benefit cliff, where if you earn below a certain amount, you get the benefit, and if you earn above a certain amount, you don't get the benefit, it puts families in a really difficult position. Like Catherine was saying, she earned $80 too much to get a benefit. And so if we pay attention to how we set programs up administratively so there can be sort of extended phase in and phase out ranges so that families don't hit that benefit cliff, it can help make families feel more secure that as their income rises, they're not all of a sudden going to lose a benefit.
Catherine, thanks again for calling in. Sarah, what are you watching for now? And I assume we're still probably gathering data on this, but when it comes to the impact of COVID-19 and the economic damage it caused on poverty here in Wisconsin.
So we can see that things are, you know, difficult across the state and across the nation. That's very clear. One thing that I'm paying attention to are the ways that the pandemic is really shining a light on some of the disadvantages that already existed before. So, you know, the first caller talked about the value of care work and how there's a new discussion about that. We've heard discussion during the pandemic of paying attention to racial and ethnic health disparities and those sorts of things. All of these things existed before the pandemic, and the pandemic is really shining a light on them. And so I think we're paying attention to some disadvantages that often got swept under the rug before. The other thing that go ahead.
I was going to say very briefly, Sarah, if we're paying attention to those, do you see movement to change things to fix some of those pre-existing problems?
I think the conversation is starting to recognize them, and recognizing a problem is a first step to being able to solve it, because if you don't recognize it, you can't solve it. But I think it really remains to be seen what policy movement will be, both at the, you know, local, state, and federal levels around those areas.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked about poverty here in Wisconsin, the impact it has, and policies that could help deal with it. Earlier, we talked to a guest about how poverty is measured around the country, what it does and doesn't take into account.